Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. It's a Tim's Day here. Tim Priester with Tim O'Malley, Monday, March 27th. We had an opportunity to see the first five periods of Saturday's practice. I was on the defensive side of the ball. Tim and I have agreed that the offensive side of the ball is more fun to cover for five periods if you only have five periods, because they're throwing a football around. And Tim, they never got into any kind of team stuff, 7-on-7, let alone 11-on-11. So I wasn't able to, you're a lot better at it than I am. I wasn't able to pull out a whole lot about the defensive side of the ball, but we do have comments, I think, on individuals and how they look. I had an opportunity to get up close to the defensive line as L. Washington was working with those guys. We'll talk about that, but just some of the things that you saw in practice three of 2023 spring.
Yeah, I didn't see much of the running backs because they were not hitting. They started hitting the second we were leaving. That would have been a really good time to watch the running backs when they were doing the first and goal from the 10-yard line drill. I thought that would have been a nice period six to see. But the receiving, there's a question on Irish Illustrated. What group looks better from your brief viewing from last year, quarterbacks or receivers? And the receivers look a lot better and deeper and more athletic. Got to remember, spring last year, we had a very low opinion of the receivers. It turned out to be correct. Joe Wilkins was part of the group. By the time he came back, he quit the team. The receivers have come a long way, but I must say, if you were to go quarterback one, two, three, four, no names, quarterback one throws a lot better than quarterback one last year. Quarterback two looks better than quarterback two last year, and three and four look a lot better than three and four last year. I really like the quarterback room. They are, of course, throwing against air while we're in there, but Angeli had some beautiful deep corner routes. Sam Hartman, you can tell who's throwing it. Tyler Buckner, I made note, he threw that. I always called it the deep cross. It's the over route. He threw a couple of really nice over routes. And anytime Kenny Minchie missed, you knew it was just being a rookie because it looked like he was aiming it. When he just throws it, a deep pass, it's a pretty looking ball too. So I think the quarterback room went from what in the world last year to an enviable room.
I can't disagree. Sam Hartman's presence on the field can be felt. I think Tyler Buckner's maturity can be felt to a large degree too. I appreciate the interaction that you see between those two guys, and that's what we expected of Buckner. Of course, there's going to be disappointment when he knows that a guy with 110 touchdown passes and 13,000 yards is coming in to take over the job or to win the job. But I don't think there's any doubt about what you're saying there, Tim. And you know, Kenny Minchie does not carry himself like a freshman.
He doesn't.
He does not in an interview room, and he doesn't on the practice field, and he throws a good ball. So yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I don't want to overplay the receivers quite yet. But again, looking at body language, when I was coaching, body language was huge for me. So I refer to that all the time. And I think that Tobias Merriweather and Deion Colsey, there's just a difference in the way they carry themselves on the football.
Did we talk about this on a podcast last year? We had a body language comparison last spring and last August, even, of Deion Colsey to Ishaq Williams, who you would never think had the best body language at Notre Dame. And I agree with you. Colsey, I know we also have the background of Colsey has played some ball and made some plays now, so we see that in our minds. Yeah, but
no doubt.
Yeah, I had to double take a couple times with Merriweather. I'm like, oh man, that kid does not look like a kid right now. And that's why Caleb Smith said, I did not believe people when they told me Tobias was a freshman. I thought that was the good takeaway from him. Yeah, I don't want to overstate it either, because last year in August, Chris Tyree looked like a new man when we were watching people do footwork drills. That's not all what football is. So we don't want to overplay what we see in the five periods, but those two groups certainly look better. I am wondering what I got a good look at Michael Carmody. We had heard last November, December, he might be slimming down to be another one of those move tight ends. He would have to bulk up to play, right? Don't you agree at this point?
Well, he's listed at 280. I think he looks like he weighs more than that. And I always go back to Brian Kelly commenting a couple of years ago that he was stronger than his size or stronger than his age.
Right. Right.
But 280 is not enough. I mean,
it's not a guard too. Zeke's not huge. Zeke on our board, people pointed out Zeke Correll's not a huge center. He's the right size college center, but you'd be putting 280 next to 300.
Yeah.
That's different.
But again, I think there's an overreaction to the first week of practice, because that's what a coaching staff is going to do. They're going to put the older guy out there and at least give him a week to run up front. You know, I don't know how much ones and twos they're doing. We certainly haven't seen it. I'm sure once we leave that they're doing quite a bit of that. You know, Saturday was the first day they were in pads, so that was the first, you know, day of any real physicality. But now, yeah, 280 is a bit startling. But again, I'm going to be open mind. Could he be 290 by the fall? I mean, I think anything beyond that could get a little bit sloppy, especially if he's been working on on trimming down and playing tackle or move tight end, as you suggested. 280 stands out. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So it'll be interesting to see what they do next. Billy Shrouth would be the he's over 300 pounds. And he would be the guy that would, quote, beat out Carmody for that spot, or so it appears at this point. But I don't want to overreact.
Right. And, you know,
second, third practice of spring.
The info you got, too, or we received about Coogan moving to guard, I think he's still probably moving to guard. You know what you need is, in the spring, you need to rotate your centers 1, 2, 3 to have a quality lineup going. Yeah. And the only way to do that is if you have three centers and Ashton Craig. I bet they develop Craig into center number two by end of August camp, whereas Pat Coogan probably has to hold it down a little bit here. And he gets more reps if he's playing there, too. They can take a look at Coogan, Spindler, Shroff, everybody, because Coogan's playing center.
Yeah, just the reality is that I think Coogan's a more realistic number two right guard than Spindler is until we see otherwise.
I agree. Right? I agree.
Until we see otherwise. Kicking was not good. Was not really, but we could not tell. It was difficult from my angle. Anytime you're on the sideline and they don't have a student manager underneath the goalpost signaling good or not good, it's very difficult.
Yeah, we were on the ground this time. We're on the ground, not in the balcony this time, because all the recruits were up top.
I'm not sure. Maybe balcony would help a little bit more for that angle. I'm always complaining about when we're in the balcony, I'm saying I can't see all the way across the field. And when we're on the field, I'm saying I can't see through the body. So I don't know. They're going to have to, I'm going to have one of those, NBC has a guy on the sideline driving back and forth on that little that little automobile with the,
maybe they'll let you shadow. They could let you shadow Freeman for a couple of practices.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, I'm having a tough time getting the right angle, but it's hard to see kicks when you're on the sideline. And it would appear to us that the two kickers, and it wasn't, I don't know if you got the memo on this. I changed this in our stories about Brian Dowd was the second kicker, not Chris Salerno, the brother of Matt. And of course, Zach Yoakum. But I don't know that any of us expect Zach Yoakum to win the kicking job. He did a hell of a job as a kickoff man. Spencer Schrader will arrive this summer, and he's expected to be the kicker. So, but that wasn't really good. We didn't see any return stuff on Saturday. I could get into more of what I saw, but I think I'm going to walk over some of the questions in terms of, you know, heights and weights and size. And I did get up close, as I mentioned, to the defensive line and got some impressions as I was standing there while Al Washington was coaching them up. Tim, what else from Saturday before we go to segment two?
It's the full practice is going to help you a lot on Saturday, because you'll get to see some hitting and probably offensive linemen settling in a little bit. That'll be practice number seven by then. Seven, eight. They don't practice quite as much. It's probably seven. They don't practice quite as much in the spring.
That'll be six on Saturday. Six.
Yeah. You would think that'd be some pretty heavy hitting. Probably let you know where some of the reserve linemen stand by then. We could speak more intelligently about Shroff versus Coogan versus Carell. Yeah. My takeaway was I want to make sure I watch as much as possible Lorenzo Styles, so we don't just talk ourselves into bounce back here, Lorenzo Styles, because
what did you see Saturday? Because I liked, again, talking body language, liked his body language on day one.
I did too. I watched them it's in the practice report, but you catch a pass going, it's basically you're catching a pass in the flat, but your back is to the defense and you're going horizontally. You got to get vertically and make a cut. He really did have the nicest cut. I mean, it was a really nice jump cut where if you didn't know all the players, and you're just like, who's that? I thought Lorenzo Styles had the best. I mean, yeah, Lorenzo Styles had the best cut. I hadn't seen that jump cut in space from all year last year.
One of the I wrote about this in the defensive practice report Saturday, and they work on this a lot. And I think under Marcus Freeman, it's something they work on more than they did with Brian Kelly, and that's the 3-on-3 matchup. Yeah. Between the three bunched receivers against an outside linebacker, a safety, and a cornerback generally. And I think it's really important that you work on those kind of things, because you better be absolutely assignment correct against a bunch formation, which we're seeing more of by season. You have to know what your role is. You have to know what's the trigger to make you switch with your defensive teammate next to you. And it's something that they start practice with a lot. I think it's important. It's an important part of the game now for offense and defense. It's a good drill for the three receivers too, dealing with what the three defensive players are throwing at them.
That would have been the best drill of the season that we get to watch if it wasn't walk-on receivers versus varsity players. Yeah, that was some of that. But yeah, I like that as well. And Morrison, as you saw last year, defended it well. Cam Hart better last year than the year before. I remember Cam Hart had some weird misses in space this year before, but JD Bertrand's really good against that play. Jack Kaiser's great against that play. You're right. It's something that we definitely see it more under Marcus Freeman, and it's a good way to start practice, because it's a highly competitive, it's full speed hitting. I mean, they are coming in. Someone drilled Bertrand. I forget which one of his teammates. That was Ramon Henderson. Really got Bertrand, and I was field level. I'm like, man, he took a shot from Henderson, a mishit that got him. So it's a good way to – it's good for us to see, but it'll be a lot more fun to see if we can get Mitchell Evans, Tobias Merriweather, and Lorenzo Styles out there instead of the walk-ons getting smashed.
No doubt. And for the record, I audibly heard Mike Mickens commending Chance Tucker for the way he dealt with one of those situations. And you know what, Tim, let's finish on one more topic here in segment one, and that, because I don't think I have a question in the second segment about it, but I know a lot of our readers are talking about why haven't they moved the cornerback to safety yet. Number one, we're expecting it at this point now, since Marcus Freeman mentioned it a couple weeks ago, a transfer safety coming in. But what are your thoughts on moving a cornerback to safety, and who might that be?
So there's three options, and I have never thought of Chance Tucker as an option, so I still don't. I think Chance Tucker is a cornerback in a cornerback's body, and he could be a good reserve cornerback. I think Ryan Barnes, I don't know if moving Ryan Barnes to safety allows you to play Barnes on game days. That's a situation. Does that help you?
I don't either, but he would be the more logical.
He's the more logical move, but I like Clarence Lewis at corner too, but Clarence Lewis could probably handle it the best in terms of that's not going to be a rough adjustment for Clarence Lewis. He knows everything about the secondary and everything about the defense. I think the only Chance Tucker move I've heard is from our message boards. I don't think Tucker.
No, I agree. I didn't bring up Tucker to suggest he should move. I was mentioning him, being commended by Mike Mickens, but I think more people are interested in seeing Clarence Lewis move to that position. And I think the coaching staff is looking at it like all that we've invested in Clarence Lewis to become a better cornerback and nickel on occasion last year. Now we're going to move him to safety as he approaches the last portion of his college career, which he does have 2 years of eligibility left because of COVID.
Right.
But I wouldn't.
Maybe it's because you can look at the cornerbacks room and say, all right, they have Morrison and Hart once Hart is back. They have up-and-coming player Chance Tucker, up-and-coming player last year Jaden Mickey, everyone's favorite freshman in Christian Gray, and Clarence Lewis. Safety doesn't have anything I just said. So then we got to move somebody like Clarence Lewis.
I get it, and it certainly makes sense. And maybe they have a larger role for Thomas Harper at safety that we're aware of. But I certainly understand the reaction. I'm just saying, again, my first reaction is, why are they not moving somebody, as opposed to what the hell are they doing? Why haven't they moved somebody? Yeah.
So I think that's key. You know, I don't know if Barnes can transition safety right now, because I don't think
he dabbled there, and maybe they just don't like him there. But when do we get a chance to talk to Chris O'Leary? We get the chance to talk to O'Leary.
Not this week, but next.
April 4th. So I don't know Mickens. When does Mickens come? Mickens comes after that. So I'm not sure that we'll have an opportunity to actually speak with a coach to address that specifically, but we'll, every time we go out there on Saturday, I'll certainly be looking to see who's at safety and if anybody has switched from the cornerback position. Coming up, segment two, burning up the boards.
Segment two, burning up the boards. Our first question comes from Irish from A2. Even though he's the tight ends coach, do you think this will be a relatively unproductive year for Notre Dame's tight ends in Jared Parker's offense?
You know, unproductive in terms of will the tight ends match the number of catches that the previous tight end had? I mean, it's you can probably combine them all and they're not going to.
Right.
May not even come close. I wouldn't label it as unproductive because I do think, and I think you feel the same way, I think Mitchell Evans can be, you know, I mean, I don't know if he used the word weapon, but I think he can be an effective tight end. Not so much, you know, not as far downfield as Mayer was at times, I don't think. But, you know, I like Holden Stays a lot. That was the first opportunity I've had to speak with him, and I like him even more. Very mature kid, very confident kid, good size. I don't know. I mean, it depends how you determine productivity, but it's almost undoubtedly not going to be the kind of numbers that Mayer had. But, you know, we're talking about an improved receiving corps, so that should balance out.
I think it's a massive drop off in numbers, but they will have a productive year at tight end. And people, I think Notre Dame's tight end room is going to be good again. I like Evans. I think I like Evans more than most people do. I like Stays more than I did when I showed up a week ago because I got a look at him. Last year, he looked like a wide receiver because he might have been built like a wide receiver. Let's be honest. Why he was running down the field so fast. Now he runs like that, bigger. And
Eli Raritan is going to be a quality pass-catching tight end.
Yeah, and he can just he can join the fray in late September. He doesn't have to be ready for that first game. I love Notre Dame's tight ends this year. It's just last year they had one of the two best tight end rooms in the country, and you cannot say that this year until season's end when you've watched tight ends play. But it was Michael Mayer, 101 targets. That was Tyler Eifert in 2012, had 98 targets, and those things both happened because the wide receivers weren't good enough.
Right.
That's why that happened.
True. And I should clarify, Eli Raritan, you know, when he's healthy, I don't know exactly when he will, you know, be at full speed, but a healthy Eli Raritan is a real threat catching the football downfield.
Yeah. And I think you'll see more 12 package than most readers and maybe most podcasters think. And I don't mean it's going to be the preponderance of the snaps at all. I just think Holden Stays and Mitchell Evans is a comfort zone for Jared Parker and the running game, even with Sam Hartman. Two receivers is great when they're going downfield. There's no problem there. And Holden Stays is a wide receiver in a tight end's body. So I do think you're going to see more 12 than other people think. Not last year, it was a staple. It was a staple because the guy could never come off the field. Plus, when you sub somebody in, 25% of the time it became a tight end.
Yes. Yeah. And again, we don't know how much, you know, we don't know exactly how Jared Parker is going to use tight ends. I know he's a tight ends coach, so you would think that he wants to get more tight ends on the field, but I don't know that that's, I don't know.
No, I don't know, but in my Mitchell Evans story, which will be out probably this morning or later on, Mitchell Evans talks about how Jared Parker is using the tight end and even offers what routes he likes to use. So it was a good conversation to have.
Yeah. I don't know if you caught this, and it was in my story on Parker yesterday about him talking about, because I asked him, you know, what adjustment Hartman has to make to Notre Dame and his offense. And the first thing he said was taking snaps under center, which was not something I expected him to say. But again, he was talking about being true to Notre Dame's strengths and the kind of, you know, offensive defensive line team that Marcus Freeman wants. And that sometimes they're going to get under center a little bit more, which should assist maybe the short yardage stuff and some of the things that they want to do running the football. I thought that was interesting. It was the last thing that I expected him to say that Hartman had to adjust to, but obviously Hartman hasn't been under center a whole lot in recent years at Wake Forest. And in today's game, most quarterbacks aren't. So,
well, now you have something to get people really mad at in late March. Notre Dame being under center the entire time with three tight ends and no wide receivers. There we go. That's on IrishIllustrated.com, everybody. So next question from Ben Dorsch. Any early rumblings on Jason Anie, Josh Burnham, Tyson Ford, Aiden Gobira, or Junior Tui Halamaka? It feels like one or two need to be rotational players at the very least.
This is a really good question because I believe Marcus Freeman, did he mention, you know, up to 10 defensive linemen contributing? Yep. Didn't he say that?
Eight, but it can be 10.
Right.
Need it. You need eight. You absolutely have to have 8. 10.
Okay. But then when you look at this, the guys that we know will be contributing on a regular basis. Jean Baptiste, 1. Vitello, 2. Osafa Mensa, 3. Tui Alamaka, 4, since he played last year. Cross would be 5. Rubio would be 6.
Mills.
Kiana Aina would be...
Riley Mills.
Oh, I'm sorry, Riley Mills. You know, I had him on two different lists here.
That's 7. Riley
Mills, 7. And then, at, you know, Kiana Aina maybe 8, but we're not positive about that. So if you're talking about 8 to 10, I think it's a really good question. And I don't have the answer because I don't have any rumblings per se, but I did spend some time around the defensive line the other day, and it did strike me that Jason Ane is a big dude, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't really highly rated coming out of high school, and I don't know, you know, exactly where he is in the grand scheme of things for them, but he's 6'4.5", 292. So that's a good size interior defensive lineman. Tyson Ford. Why am I not finding him? What number is he, Tim? He
gained 17 pounds basically up to 292. 17.
Yeah.
Although I think he was bigger than what they listed him. I think he was bigger than what they listed him as last year. He gained 17 from the roster.
Okay. Well, that could be. So, I mean, those are two guys that when you're up close and watching them practice, those are some big dudes. They have some length and they're pushing 300 pounds. Gobira's bigger. I think he's 10 pounds more, but before I even saw what his weight was, watching him the other day, it's like, okay, he's bigger than he was, you know, last fall. Burnham has gained weight too, but he's still 247. Now he's a defensive end, he's a rush end, and so that, you know, that it's hard to put a number on a rush end weight wise because that can definitely vary. But it's a good question. I don't know. I haven't heard any rumblings yet. I haven't had really an opportunity to talk specific D-line stuff, but the question's a good one because, yeah, they need to develop one or two more. And I think it would more likely be Burnham, Ford, Anya, as opposed to Gobira at this point. Tui Alamaka, I would include. He played last year, so you would think that he'd be in the mix again this year.
Plus, Burnham, when you say, if someone wants to say Burnham's not big enough, he's big enough for a reserve Viper role, which is what he's going into. You can't say he's not going to hold up all year at Viper. He doesn't have to hold up all year at Viper. He has to hold up for
8 snaps, 10 snaps, something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. And I think his skill set is different than that of the bigger Vipers. Yeah. And Jordan Botello, man, that guy looks like a Viper. Also, in the Mitch Levin story, he mentioned that Holden Stays was able to, quote, survive, unquote, going against Botello, who's also a dog. I thought that was telling because he's like, you got to survive against Botello. That's a good sign for Notre Dame. The tight end has to survive against Jordan Botello going one-on-one.
Who did you say? Who said that?
Mitch Levin said that about Holden Stays.
Oh, well, Holden Stays said that about Botello.
That he's a dog?
Yeah, I
would not want to face that guy in practice or games.
I think it was Samson that asked him, who's the toughest guy you go against? And he did not hesitate. And he said Botello. So, I mean, that's great to hear. It's something we've been saying that he's a guy that has to be he can't be hit and miss anymore for Notre Dame to be productive from that position. And that's a good sign. I mean, he looks to me like he's on the verge of that. For him, it's more about controlling your emotions and staying composed and knowing how to go from play to play and not getting too high and getting too low. Yeah. I think it's more getting too high as opposed to getting too low. Sure. You know, in terms of your emotions on the football field. Question from JD Campbell, 40. With Jaden Mickey, the sentiment this season is he needs to return to his spring of 2022 form when he broke onto the scene. This breakout was against a depleted and undeveloped receiver core. Should we be reassessing our expectations until we see consistency against a true receiver group or in a game?
It's a good question because I agree with the answer. I don't necessarily know that Mickey only excelled, however, last year because he was going against a depleted and underdeveloped receiver group. I thought Jaden Mickey just looked like a future football player last year The problem is, I believe that was taken as the future was now, then, to 2022. And it doesn't, that's just not the way it works. Clarence Lewis and Cam Hart were better players than Jaden Mickey last year. And you saw it on the field. I want to reevaluate everything I see Jaden Mickey when I see him play Ohio State, because Mickey last year struggled against Ohio State publicly, BYU publicly, and USC famously. Other than that, I think he was a little better than maybe I give him credit for. So I'd like to go back and look at other games Jaden Mickey played. It's just I happen to remember the tragic results of some of the plays.
I think the biggest issue with him is just overall strength. I mean, you can be quick, yeah. You can be a great athlete, but man, if you're out there with a bunch of men, and he was not a man last year when he was playing for Notre Dame. He wasn't mentally, emotionally, confidence wise, he may have been, or he went into it that way. But so I think with him, it's just strength. And my reaction to this question, I get it. It is a good question from JD Campbell 40, but my reaction to it was, you can say that then when you're watching a recruit and he's going against inferior competition, you still have to be able to single that guy out, evaluate his technique and how he deals with play, regardless of the competition. So I think what Jaden Mickey showed last year was legitimate. I don't think there's any reason to think otherwise. Could he have gone against better receivers? Yeah, but he's doing some fundamentally things right.
Right.
That would prompt the coaching staff to be very high on him, regardless of the competition. And that's why I bring up evaluating a recruit on high school film, because it has to go deeper in your evaluation than just who he's going against.
As he's going to be confident going against those guys, which points to JD Campbell. He probably gained a lot of confidence going against guys that he was playing better than last year in spring practice. Next from Annie Davis, thoughts on Blake Fisher's notably svelte appearance and any commentary on the updated heights weights for the spring.
Fisher looks great, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
I mean, really moving well, 310. Am I correct in this? There was a time when he was listed 335.
Last year on the roster. Well,
that's a good 25 pounds. No, he looks great. I mean, we can bounce around a little bit here on the roster, Tim, if you want to talk about it. We mentioned those young defensive tackles. Rubio's at 302, 7 pounds heavier. I think he looks really, really good physically. Love the way Botello looks at 255. Jaden Thomas, does that guy look good in a football uniform now?
Yeah, that sloppiness is missing, I think, from what, well, it's not even what we observed last year. We were told Jaden Thomas needed to cut weight and add strength last year.
That was part of the conversation. I see Leifau at 235. I'm not really sure how much more that is, but I think that's a good number for him.
Spindler 325, I didn't notice from, but that's, he went from 305 to 315 to 325.
Yeah,
that's certainly looking to hold out. Yeah, if it's good weight, that can't hurt him.
Yeah, because he needs to be able to be able to hold the point of attack, better than he has, or to be able to move the line of scrimmage better than he has been able to do that. Other guy, Ben Morrison, is up 6 pounds. That may not seem like a lot, but for somebody as aggressive and as physical as he is, being up to 185 is good. If he could be a good 190 by the fall, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, and Tobias, I think, carries. I think anytime Tobias keeps gaining 7 pounds for the rest of his career is good, because he's just so long and he can easily handle seven more pounds on his frame. So it's up to 205. I said it just looked like a man out there, and gonna be fun to watch him the rest of this spring. The rest of the guy, like Chance Tucker, needed the weight. It's good that Chance Tucker put that on for a larger role. And then Jordan Botello, I think it's good. 255 is probably where you want your almost every down Viper.
Yeah, I thought he looked really good physically the other day, standing behind the defensive line. Rico Flores at 198. I don't think that surprises any of us.
No, I like the way Rico Flores looks.
His lower body strength is pretty special for a high school senior.
I pulled Tom aside, Tom Loy, in practice, and I was like, look, man, I got to tell you something. What Rico Flores looks like to me, and I don't mean when he's catching passes or running down the field and running post routes. Right. he just reminds me of his gait, his hair, and his build of Larry Fitzgerald. And of course, Jeremy starts laughing. I was like, I just mean, look at him. And Loy looks over and he's like, Loy's like, you know what? That's really right.
And really, Kevin Sinclair, I think that's really fair.
I hadn't said a word to Kevin. Kevin sent me a text.
He's going to be as good as Larry Fitzgerald.
No. I just think he looks like him. And right, Kevin sent me a text the same day. He's like, just yesterday, I told somebody he looks like Larry Fitzgerald to me. So there you go. That's the other part from Irish Illustrated. Larry Fitzgerald is on Notre Dame's roster, and he will be the featured wide receiver.
I don't know that Braylon James looks 195 to me.
I don't think so either.
But if he is, that's great.
We have a question coming up for wide receivers later, so we will let's save
we'll stay free from that. Christian Gray at 184 I think is a good number for him. Osafa Mensah looks bigger to me at 260 looks good. We haven't had a chance to see Thomas Harper because he's banged up, but if he's a legit 195, that's a really good number for him, I think, because I've seen how he plays and he's quick, and if he's a quick 195, that's a good number. Who else? We talked about Carmody. He's almost undoubtedly going to have to be bigger than that.
Yeah, I think it's good that Coogan hasn't been gaining weight. Remember, as a freshman, I just said that dude's just too big to be playing every down.
And yeah, he looked huge. I didn't think it was a sloppy huge as a freshman, but he
had to get rid of it though.
With really good size. So anybody else? I think that's those are the guys that I wanted to talk about. Question from DJ SJNDFB. What did you think of the New York Times op-ed written by Father Jenkins and Jack Swarbrick?
Well, the issue I have with it as well has been stated publicly by many. It is the NCAA's fault. It is the college coaches, presidents, and athletic directors' fault that we got to this point. But that's no longer where we are trying to fix it. So I am not against Congress trying to fix the problem that is 100%. Self-inflicted by those that have made money off of players for all these years. That is definitely a fault of the NCAA and the people that make money from this. But you have to move forward and figure out a way to control NIL, because this has just absolutely nothing to do with NIL. I shouldn't say absolutely nothing. Some guys make money off real NIL deals. But the recruitment of players and the enticements of players has nothing to do with NIL. It's not what NIL was supposed to be about. Now, if you want to be upset that coaches and athletic directors and colleges continue to have massive revenue streams because of these players, but they want to limit the players, I totally get it. That's what the original NIL fight was about. I just don't know what Congress will do, though, Tim, either in this situation to fix the problem they're going to be handed.
I don't know, but they're the ones that wield the most power, so I understand why Notre Dame. I mean, clearly, Jack Swarbrick has said this for a while, that he believes that to be clear, nobody wants to say, Congress, please help us, but they've reached a point where they feel that it's necessary to do that. I found it interesting that the letter urged the NFL and the NBA, well, the NFL, to create a minor league system and for the NBA to, you know, essentially eliminate the one and done situation that colleges find themselves in.
Yeah, it's hard for the NFL and NBA to care about these things.
I get that, but college is the one that is supplying them with
it. I feel like it still supplies the talent, though. Like, if the NFL doesn't care what Sam Hartman's NIL deal is to come to Notre Dame, or if it was to go to Alabama, they get to see Sam Hartman play and they will draft him from that. Like, I just think it's outside their problems. The NBA certainly doesn't care what 20 college basketball players from the NCAA will ever make because of Europe and the glut of talent there is everywhere. How many college basketball players make the NBA every year?
Boy, not many.
I don't think they care where that money comes from. I don't care if they transfer four times. You know, I'm not saying I know the fix. I just don't think the NBA and the NFL are the fix. No,
I agree. I guess I would like to think that they could work together a little bit better. But to your original point, I mean, the NCAA abdicated their authority. I mean, they created this, and we've talked about it before, that had you just been a little bit forward thinking and given, you know, we talk about Notre Dame and $25,000 per scholarship football player. If you'd done that across the board in college football 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah. It's that you'd have NIL now, an actual one.
you probably would. And I get where Notre Dame, I get where Jack Swarbrick and Father Jenkins are coming from on this. And, you know, when they say 99% of their student athletes that stay to get their degree or stay for 4 years, get their degree. I mean, they do. That's what, you know, Notre Dame does. But the problem is the genie is out of the bottle here with NIL, and it is pay for play. And, you know, the whole idea of profiting from your celebrity is so far beyond that now. That
and the whole, it's not profiting from your celebrity. It's your presence. It's your promise. It's your, and look, you could say, well, anybody could be paid for their promise. Well, anybody that's getting paid for their promise should then be removed from their job for not showing out on that promise. And people get really mad. No, listen to me. If people can, other teams can do this. Let's say Notre Dame paid for Dante Moore. Paid him $1 million to come to Notre Dame. And then Dante Moore stunk. What happens when Notre Dame tries to cut Dante Moore? How does that look for Marcus Freeman and anybody else when Notre Dame would never remove a scholarship? Well, we were paying the guy $1 million and he's not any good. So I tried to use an extreme example here because Dante Moore probably would not get cut after 1 year. But let's just say he stinks straight out, flat out, like this guy can't play. We can't keep paying him. That's a huge situation that's been created too. You're not paying for, it's pay for play, not pay for promise. I said this 3 years ago. If you want to get paid, you have to allow to be get cut. And Notre Dame doesn't want to cut people from their scholarships. Good for them. I have less of a problem cutting someone from their scholarship, not their scholarship, from their payment, from their NIL payment. I don't think you should get paid if you're not any good. But that has nothing to do with this, of course. But Notre Dame, Swarbrick, and Jenkins cannot feel that way. They are educators. They make a lot of money. Rex Warbrick and Notre Dame makes a lot of money off of this, but they also have to protect the interests of the university. And I talked to someone at Notre Dame during the pro day. If you don't think Notre Dame wants to operate differently around NIL and getting people into school that are transfers, you're just going to be very, very disappointed for a long time.
And I've said this before as well. I mean, Marcus Freeman's uncomfortable with it too. He is learning how to deal with NIL because he's a head coach. I know we laughed about, would you rather have the talent and then deal with the problems with that? Of course, but there's a reality in coaching, and that is what happens behind closed doors has a huge impact on the togetherness and the unity of your entire football program. The moving parts within a football program it's unbelievable. I mean, it's numbers. Man, that the sports that you and I basically generally play, Tim, were considerably less than that. And so that's an issue, not just for Notre Dame, the university, but for Notre Dame, the football department as well. So I understand where Father Jenkins and Jack Swarbrick are coming from here. You knew as soon as it was published that there would be people that would jump on it, and that's perfectly fine. But I think the essence of what they're saying is that we are going to lose college football as we know it. And I think
we definitely will lose college football. No, I think enough people don't care about that. As long as college football on TV is a good product for them to watch, that is not what a longtime Notre Dame fan probably fell in love with Notre Dame for. Maybe we have to get used to that if you're going to continue to watch college football. I did not watch much football last year, I must say, and think to myself, well, they wouldn't have him if it wasn't for NIL. I just watched the football games and they unfolded. Sure. I did occasionally watch Alabama. Now look, Alabama didn't make the playoffs, so that's great, but I did watch Alabama and think, why the hell are they allowed to have Jahmyr Gibbs? That's an issue too. That's a weird free agency thing, but that is definitely the new normal because that has nothing to do with regulation of NIL. I mean, if Jahmyr Gibbs could make money transferring somewhere and it's going to be regulated, let's say by Congress, he's going to choose Alabama because they're better.
Right. Yeah.
So it's still going to be the haves and the have nots. And we have a long way to go. And I understand the people that think this is your creation, not specifically Notre Dame and Father Jenkins, Jack Swarbrick's creation, but it is certainly college football's creation that we are in this spot.
Question from Fighting Irish Lover 7. Rank the new wide receivers based on immediate impact to the team and then based on career impact. I'm a little hesitant to talk about career impact based upon
two
abbreviated observations. And go ahead, Tim, and include Caleb Smith in this group too.
Right. And I'm glad this question was asked because career impact on the team for both Tim Priester and I, after watching 10 periods, five of which both of us watched wide receivers completely, should be almost no different than the career impact we wrote down on signing day, because not much has changed yet. We've only heard good feedback about the players. My number one in this group for career was Jaden Greathouse. He was fourth on my total list. My number two was Rico Flores, and we had a long conversation about it. He was eighth. And my number three was Braylon James, and he was nine. I get all arguments to the Braylon James can become a better player with a higher ceiling than than Flores. Sometimes that low floor or the high floor in college football, and you don't become a first round draft pick, still makes you a damn good college football wide receiver. So I really don't want to go away from Flores because I just like him as a player. I get the Braylon James has a better chance of being a second round draft pick than Rico Flores.
When you said that, what the statement you just made, I immediately thought of Raymond McKnight. I don't think any of us thought Raymond McKnight was going to be a good pro, but he was a hell of a college college wide receiver eventually by the time he played with Notre Dame. Where would you put Caleb Smith? I haven't really seen an explosive Caleb Smith yet. I don't know how much.
No, neither have I. I think Caleb Smith and Sam Hartman will have a good connection this year. Yeah. I mean, this is ridiculous to say. I can see all three of these other guys having a higher ceiling than Caleb Smith, but that's just because he's a Virginia Tech graduate transfer that had to come to Notre Dame for another year. So I'm sullied by thinking of it that way. Right. Yeah. Someday one of these guys won't have a higher ceiling than Caleb Smith. That's just the reality of recruiting the position. But I have not seen, again, I've watched five periods and three included wide receivers because I watched defense the other day. I haven't seen the explosive Caleb Smith either, but I also haven't seen explosive Jaden Greathouse jump up and make an amazing catch on anyone because we haven't seen them go one-on-one.
No, I did see him make an amazing in a drill in which, you know, they run at Stuckey and Stuckey throws him a bad ball or high ball. I saw Greathouse make an amazing leaping grab.
And that's good too.
You know, it's, you know, that, yeah. But, well, you know, I was hesitant to rank Flores too high because of his catch radius.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting the name of the receiver. It's been a while ago, probably, I don't know, 8 to 10 years ago, a wideout that.
From Notre Dame?
I'll think of it. A wideout that I liked him coming out of high school, but didn't have big catch radius, so I was a little bit cautious with Flores, but now we've seen him in person and physically the lower body strength looks to be incredible. Braylon James frankly has looked a little bit better than I thought. I mean, we've seen some of the clips, some of the good, the really nice catches that he's made downfield and over the shoulder grab. I know everybody was gushing about a Hartman deep ball to him, which is what, you know, Hartman should be able to throw.
You know, he should be able to beat a lot of Notre Dame's freshman corners on these deep balls.
Right. I mean, he should be able to hit a wide open wide out that's 5 yards past the DB. But it's hard for me to rate him. I think Braylon James probably in terms of readiness to contribute right away is below the other two. And certainly Caleb Smith as well. The upside could very
Caleb well Smith is ready. Caleb Smith's going to contribute. I don't want to doubt that. He's ready to contribute for sure.
I can see where the ceiling for Braylon James is higher than the other guys.
I know that our recruiting guys, Loy and Sinclair, feel that way too.
Yeah. Just look at their bodies. Look how they play. Look at the, you know, Braylon James is a pretty special athlete, but
it's okay to be great in college. It's okay to just be great in college.
That's really all we're caring about here. But I do want to mention, and I know it'll be lost when the freshmen aren't in the rotation in September, but you have Jaden Thomas, who's really starting to blossom. Colsey and Merriweather, you know, similar style receivers and coming of age. And I expect Styles to, you know, to have a bounce back year. So, and with Caleb Smith's experience, those guys are going to get snaps ahead. But Rico Flores can't. I mean, if what we've seen in this short amount of time is legit, you would think that would be a guy that can probably help you.
Yeah, right away. I think so. And we'll know more at the end of the spring. And kind of when you talk to not behind the scenes, because you can read what coaches say a lot, Stuckey and Freeman. If we bring up Rico Flores to Stuckey, you'll know if it's a pump the brakes situation or if, like, yeah, we got a dog right here, like that. You could just kind of tell.
No doubt.
Next question from Day by Day Don. Do you guys think we will see Prince Colley and Jalen Snead contribute a lot more versus last year? How'd they look this spring? The second part, we have no idea, but the first part we could try. You saw five periods. Did you see him touch a player?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really, you know, they're of comparable weights as they were. Everybody was impressed with, you know, the general athleticism of Prince Colley and Jalen Snead. Do I think they'll contribute a lot more? I think they will contribute more.
Snead could be a lot more because he didn't contribute much last year. I think Snead will contribute in the way he did in the Gator Bowl.
Yeah, I think so. Why don't you want to express your concern about Prince Colley? You want to say that publicly?
Yeah, I just think Colley's a good player, and I think you'll know about Colley. He should be a 1B if he's going to be an A ever.
Well, he's down to 2 years of eligibility, which
that's what I'm saying.
It's really concerning. You know, so all these guys have extra eligibility because of COVID. He doesn't, because he came in the year after that. And I'm concerned about Colley assessing this situation with 2 years to go.
I am too. It's fair too, because they're not gonna, JD Bertrand's not gonna lose many snaps. Prince Colley doesn't technically play middle anyway. I'm just pointing out JD Bertrand's not gonna lose too many snaps. We all think Barris Leafau should not have led the team in snaps last year. At least we can all agree on that with the message board and the complaints about Leafau. I don't feel like for some reason he should have led the defense in snaps. But there had to be a reason they weren't turning to Colley. I want Colley to give them the reason to make sure they turn to Colley to augment Leafau.
Totally agree.
That's the best way to say it about Prince Colley.
Yeah, I put that more on him.
Yeah, so do I.
Right. Because, I mean, why would they not want him on the field if they were confident he knew what he needed to do?
Exactly.
I get a fan's reaction to he has to play more. Well, he has to be better schooled in what his responsibilities are, and then he will play more.
That's how I feel.
People don't like JD Bertrand. Sorry, they can't take him off the field because he knows where all 22 parts need to be.
I also feel like people are kind of wrong about JD Bertrand in terms of, he could be quicker laterally, but they're wrong about his athleticism. I hate to tell everybody this, JD Bertrand's faster than Prince Colley's. Barris Leafau, he's faster than him. You guys are all going to have to live with it. I don't know if he's still faster than Jalen Snead, but he was last year. I hope not, because I thought Jalen Snead was going to be fast. So, yeah,
for point A to point B moving forward, JD Bertrand is as quick as you could ask for in a linebacker. Laterally, that's different, of course.
And Prince Colley on that play against BYU, he looked quick. He didn't always look quick, though. Let's pull up the North Carolina tape where he's just totally in the wrong gap. And it cuts a long run. That's a problem, too.
In the South Carolina game, the most recent. Yeah. No, I love that. I love the kid. I love the personality. I love the ability. He has to be better schooled in what his responsibilities are.
I will be surprised if Prince Colley is not talked about highly at the end of spring ball from Al Golden, Marcus Freeman, and Golden saying things like his consistency is just light years better than it was last year. I think that's what we will see from Colley. And if that's the case, then he can be 1B.
I agree.
Or 1A. He could be one. There's other route being 1A either. You could beat out someone. Tavon Coney came and beat out people during the 2017 season. He overtook Niles Morgan, and he overtook Greer Martini in total snaps because he became better.
Very high on Prince Colley and what his capabilities are. Absolutely. Question for Ferraro on air. What Irish quarterback all time is Sam Hartman most similar to? Whoa.
I wish I read this question because I don't know who the answer is. We're having conversations about what he, like his stature. And I mean, he's nowhere near the stature of Brady Quinn. That was one of the biggest people I've ever seen back there.
What are we talking about? Well, like all time similar to similar ability, similar stature. I mean,
similar ability, and he's got to resemble him a little bit. Otherwise it's a hard pull.
Stature. He's the same size as Ian Book.
Oh yeah. We talked about that. That's right. But Book looks more slender, but you're right. He's the same size as Ian Book.
But he sees the field better than Book did. He doesn't run the football as well as Book did. But I mean, Book did win. He did put up over the course of his career, put up really, really good numbers. I think
Hartman, they're nowhere near each other on deep balls. They're nowhere near each other on deep balls. No, so that's, no, let's get away from Book on this one. Yes,
thank you. They're nowhere near on deep balls. I mean, Hartman's better than Ian Book, but I mean, we're asking for a comparison.
He doesn't remind me of Clausen, though. He doesn't remind me of Clausen. He doesn't remind me of Clausen throwing the ball, though.
No, I mean, I think accuracy wise, Clausen was out of this world his junior year, accuracy wise.
Yeah.
Hartman's numbers don't reflect that, but I think in the right situation, he can be very, very accurate.
I mean, Clausen should have been 28 touchdowns and one pick. Three of his four picks were a Hail Mary and two drop balls that were picked off. That's insane. On a terrible team with an average offensive line.
Oh, geez. That line, average.
Yeah. Sorry, below average.
they reached average at some point.
They reached average during that season at times.
Started, but I mean, don't freak out when I say in Book. I'm comparing the body composition.
He's a better passer. He's just a better passer than Ian Book.
He is. Of course he is. Yeah, of course he is. I'm not saying that Book is as good as Hartman, but we're asking for a comparison to a Notre Dame quarterback all time.
I mean, how about deep ball? He throws a better deep ball, but the best deep ball recently was Kizer. Hartman throws a prettier ball than Kizer. I mean, Hartman's also a fifth-year senior, and Kaiser's best year was his redshirt freshman year, so this is a difficult comparison. He better be better than that. I mean, Kizer's a great runner. Kizer's an all-time underrated runner that year as a redshirt freshman. He was a weapon.
Yeah, he really
was. This is a tough one. Who's the trying to think of? He throws a prettier ball than.
It could be that there is nobody just.
There might not be. He throws a better ball than Brady Quinn, too. Brady Quinn's strong in the stature and the pocket and everything, and he's a gutsy, but I think in a moxie way. Gutsy, actually gutsy on the field.
How about Jarius Jackson? No, not really.
No. But Herman's a better
passer. I mean, again, I'm thinking body composition and makeup, because there was talk over the weekend about Brady Quinn. Well, he's not as big as Brady Quinn.
No. Not even close. Brady Quinn's a giant
factor. Well, I don't know the answer. There may not be one because you can't.
I think this will be taken well across the internet. If I say Sam Hartman at Notre Dame reminds me of Joe Montana in his prime with the 49ers. So everybody can just be happy now. That's what he looks like, guys.
Well, and there's probably somebody that we're not thinking of. And I'm sure our listeners will say, hey, what about him? And then we'll come back and say, didn't think about him. You're right. Question from Sean_McCarthy4. What are your impressions of the quarterbacks and wide receivers after week one of spring practice? We've kind of walked all over this one.
We did walk all over that one. But as I said, 1 through 4, they look better at quarterback, and wide receivers isn't a fair comparison, because if they didn't look better than last year's wide receivers after 1 week of spring practice, there'd be wholesale firings of the entire coaching staff.
Yeah,
that was awful. That was ridiculous what they had last year's
spring practice. It was really bad. I mean, it's there's a lot of hope here. There's a lot of anticipation of their passing game. When it starts with the fact that you got a trigger man like that is going to make the receivers probably look better than they really are in terms of development. Because let's face it, I mean, Colsey still has a long way to go. Merriweather has a long way to go. Having Sam Hartman throwing them football is going to shorten the learning curve for them.
Yeah.
They're going to be in a position to just, you're open, he'll get you the ball, you make a play.
And I don't want to downplay how much better they look at receiver, but last year we also had the regret of knowing the ceilings of some of the players for the year. Like Deion Colsey had a better year than I thought he could possibly have last year.
I think he had a better year than the coaching staff believed. Yes,
that's the most important thing. And Jaden Thomas had a year the coaching staff hoped he could have.
Right.
Braden Lindsey was open. I'm not taking anything away from Braden Lindsey. Braden Lindsey would like to have Sam Hartman throw the ball deep downfield too, because it'd be a bunch of touchdowns for him. And then they're counting on Joe Wilkins, who we knew was a average backup receiver that you could hope that would help your team, as opposed to he was the starting boundary receiver when he got hurt. Remember, he got hurt in April in an open practice. And that was it. Basically, they were counting on Salerno. He did make the biggest play of the game against Ohio State. Matt Salerno does not have to be in other than for blocking purposes this year. If the younger guys don't block as well as him, he'll be in there in some of those situations because he did a good job.
Yeah, Wilkins peaked against Duke in the season opener.
He had that other season opener. He had the leaping touchdown against
Florida. Oh, he did. State. That's right.
That was a nice play.
Yeah, that's right. He was
6 years, two catches. That's pretty cool that we've talked
about. Yeah, in those two instances, he was really, really good.
Next from Martin Evenflow. Do you recall a positional coach whose positive impact, both in coaching and recruiting, considering the hand he was dealt, has been greater than Chauncey Stuckey's? I guess not, because I'm sure we could think of one, but he is the notable example right now.
Yeah, I started to look at a list going back year by year. The first guy that, as I started to go back, and it's not answering the question because he was defensive coordinator. What Mike Elko did for the defense.
That's ridiculous. Yeah,
what he inherited. Now, it's not an exact comparison because that's as the coordinator, and Stuckey's a position coach with receivers. But that was the first guy that I thought of. Imagine that turnaround from the disaster that, first was inherited 4 games into the season when BVG was fired. No, Stuckey's done a great job. And let's not, again, remember, that Merriweather and Halsey have not arrived.
They haven't done anything.
They're trending real strongly, but they really haven't arrived yet.
All right, Mike Mickens.
I thought of him. I think that's probably the best comparison. I thought it took a little bit longer out of the gate than it did for Stuckey.
Stuckey's team hasn't done anything. We just like him now.
Well, and Stuckey, Styles was not good last year. I've said this many times. Just because a player doesn't play well doesn't mean the coach screwed up. You do the best that you can, but you can't develop every player. And I don't know what happened with Lorenzo Styles last year. I'm not sure that he had both feet in. I think that might have been the biggest problem of all.
This isn't totally fair because Alton Fisher got older and healthy, but Harry Hiestand last year. Had a phenomenal year compared to the year before.
I think about the development of Correll, especially after like the first couple games.
Yes. The Patterson move. It's weird that they lost all those games because it seemed like they all did well.
Yeah. Good question. We're going to flip to basketball here real quick from Packy P. What was it about Micah Shrewsbury that got Jack Swarbrick locked in on him from the get-go before his Big Ten tournament and NCAA tournament success? He's only been a head coach at the major college level for 2 years. I like the hire, but just curious why Swarbrick was fixated on him from the jump.
The word is not holistic. That's what all the players and coaches use, but it's improper. He, in terms of recruiting battles, he will win, and the kind of change in approach from Mike Bray, I think it was always going to be part of it. A guy that will play more, a guy that will emphasize defense more, was always going to be coming in. That's what happens when you need a fresh start. And I think Shrewsbury was the best one to fixate on that would come to Notre Dame.
Yeah, because I think Notre Dame's a destination for him, not a stepping stone. People were asking, I was asked over the weekend about Dustin May at Florida Atlantic. Was he on the list? Why didn't they consider him? I expected that question to come because as soon as one of these coaches goes deep in the tournament, and it's a good question because he's a damn good coach.
Yeah.
But he's from the Indiana University tree. So I think Notre Dame probably looked at him and thought, okay.
Matt Doherty.
Right. When Mike Woodson, I don't know if Mike Woodson's in it for the long haul. He may be, I don't know, but I think they probably looked at May as a guy like, well, as soon as IU comes calling, he's going to be gone. Yeah. I don't know. Other than the NBA, I don't know that Shrewsbury is going to jump to another college. I think he would. Would he have taken in another time and place? Would he have taken the Indiana job or the Purdue job? Yeah, I think he would have done that too. But I think Notre Dame's a destination for him. And a perfect example of that is a 7-year contract that he signed.
You can't protect against someone's NBA wishes. That's just going to be, if you have a coach good enough to be coveted by the NBA, you've done your job by hiring him at Notre Dame, because that's awesome. And I want to make sure I point this out. I am not comparing May's coaching acumen to Matt Doherty, but Matt Doherty always was looking to go to North Carolina if the opportunity.
Well, and the other thing,
I'm definitely not making that comparison for anyone that heard me say Matt Doherty.
No, because he was a crazy man that was driving the players.
And not in the final, and not in the Final Four before he came.
No, definitely not. To answer the question, the coaching tree, when a coaching tree includes Brad Stevens and then the NBA experience, and I know Matt Painter hasn't done a great job against lower seeds in the NCAA tournament, but it's pretty clear that Matt Painter's a hell of a coach. So, you know, coaching tree, the desire to be at Notre Dame, the NBA and college background. I think it's good to have both. I mean, you've seen it from both sides.
I do too. I think that's a fantastic addition to the situation. And I mean, we said his run means nothing in terms of how he's going to coach next year, but it does mean something for his next 2 years of recruiting.
Yeah. I think we were asked in the last podcast, you know, what role the run played, and it had nothing to do with it. And again, looking at it from the standpoint of administrators, you don't react to every, you know, good weekend of basketball and say, okay, now that's the guy that we wanted. That this was a bigger picture thing with Shrewsbury, and Shrewsbury did Notre Dame a favor by making a run in the Big Ten tournament and playing well in the NCAA tournament and kind of paving the way for a fan base. It's like, oh, wow, this guy's pretty good. Had he lost, I mean, think about it, Tim.
Sure.
The reaction to Shrewsbury would be if he had won one game in the Big Ten tournament instead of three, and he had maybe, let's say, won the first NCAA tournament game, but then they lost by 22 in the second game.
To a team like Connecticut that could beat anybody by 22, and it wouldn't it would have nothing to do with it, his coaching ability.
How about this Final Four? Is that something?
Yeah, it is. That's a.
I got to follow anybody to have a bracket with those four.
If I will retweet Matt Fortuna's tweet about someone imitating Jim Larrañaga, because it is one of the funniest things you will ever watch.
Imitating him how?
Talking about like just using his accent and how he talks about coaching old school and talks about all New York stuff. Like it is amazing. It's absolutely incredible.
Now that dude's a hell of a coach.
Yeah.
A hell of a coach. All right, we're going to wrap up long segment two here with Tim and Tim from Justin H 79095883. Is Notre Dame going to go undefeated and win the national championship?
I think if Shrewsbury gets in a couple undergrad transfers, they will. Yes. Is that the question?
I don't think so. I think,
you think it was football. You think it was football? Let's see. That'd be tough. That would be a tough thing to do, but it'll be fun to watch if Notre Dame beat. Here's the deal. If Notre Dame ends September undefeated, everybody can say, ask this question. Are we going to go undefeated and win the national championship? Because then you can realistically ask such a question.
If you had a Clark Lee defense with what we think this offense can be.
Do I get his defensive line, or you're just saying they're going to hold people to lower point totals? Have Tillery, Okwara, Kareem?
Yeah, I'm speaking in general terms, not specific personnel. The productivity of the Clark Lee defenses with the potential of this offense, I would say, they can make a run at it. They can get to the playoffs. I'm not, you know. When Notre Dame wins, I didn't predict Notre Dame would win a national title in 1988. I promise you, I didn't.
Or in 2012, you didn't think they're going to get to the playoff. That's for sure.
You know,
2018, we kind of did after one win.
Yeah, and you know what? 1993, as obvious as it now looks, although you had Kevin McDougal was the quarterback.
And we thought Michigan was going to beat him pretty good, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's why I said get out of the Ohio State game if you beat Ohio State. Don't lose to who do they play instead of Marshall this year? Somebody like that. I haven't seen the schedule yet. Don't lose to one of those teams. But the real problem is USC is now no longer like, oh, this is a tough rivalry game they have to get past. It's wow, this is going to be a problem.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, because for the second year in a row, you've got Ohio State, Clemson, and a real USC. That's really difficult to do. But can't wait till it comes around, man. It's going to be fun. We appreciate you joining us today. We're going to be back on Thursday, March 30th. We will not have an opportunity to see practice between now and then, but we'll have interviews with L. Golden and the linebackers on Wednesday. Is that correct?
Yeah, and we can ask him if Prince Kali is going to start and if Jalen Snead is taking over for Bertrand or not in the middle. It'll be perfect. We'll you bring that question up.
Until then, Tim Priester, Tim O'Malley, Irish Illustrated Insider.